My name is Bill Grace, and we're going to be talking about this evening moral reasoning, and we're going to take a look at what's called the feminine and the masculine perspectives of that. How many people have heard of a book by Carol Gilligan? It was published about, actually, 8 or 9 years ago, called In a Different Voice. Let's see some hands. Okay. Let me show you the book. It's at our bookstore. If you haven't read it, especially any women in the audience, I would strongly encourage it. I think it's an outstanding book that gives you insight into the ways in which women view the world that might be different than men. Women who I know who have read this book have talked about it being a kind of life-changing experience in terms of justifying some of the controversies that they've felt and experienced personally, and this has shed some light on it. Come on in. Let me just, for the sake of those of you who were at the Monday session, I believe, when we talked about values and how values influence the ways in which we lead, and not just the formal leadership roles, but what I would call responsible citizenship. One of the things we talked about was values awareness. And we talked about the fact that it's easy to go through life, to make major decisions without consulting our values, without asking ourselves, what are the values that we hold and how might they influence the decision that we're about to make? Whether it's a decision for younger folks about what college to go to, about whether or not to get married and to whom, oftentimes those decisions aren't made in the context of one's values, and an interest of mine is to promote that sort of values awareness. One of the things we talked about then was, what are the core values? When you boil all the values down that we talk about, maybe on a daily basis, what core values have, core values would be those values that have the most importance to you. Some of the values we talked about are peace, love, freedom, life, family. These are core values for a lot of people. I would guess a lot of people in this room. And it's important to keep those values in mind as we consider making major decisions. What we're going to talk about tonight is the however question. What happens in our lives when we have to face a decision when two of these core values are in conflict with one another? How do we begin the process of knowing how we'll choose if for some reason we have a pop quiz from the universe, as I like to call it, and all of a sudden we have to choose between life and freedom? How would you go about beginning to make that decision if all of a sudden you were confronted with a question of choosing between life and freedom? And we're going to come back to that in just a bit. What we're going to call that is moral reasoning. And before we go too much into moral reasoning itself, I want to paint a slightly larger picture. There's a person named James Rest who used to work at Harvard University with another guy named Lawrence Kohlberg. James Rest saw the light and moved to Minnesota. James Rest, when considering Kohlberg's model, which I'm going to talk about in just a little bit, expanded the notion of moral reasoning to include four smaller steps, according to Rest. If you want to read more about him, he's actually a fairly boring writer. I hope he's not here in the room. Okay. The four issues that he talks about are, number one, moral sensitivity. That's the ability to know that there's a problem out there. The notion would be, without moral sensitivity, we could go about our daily lives and encounter these problems. They would be in our midst, but we wouldn't see them. So one of the things we do if we want to encourage values development in our children, in our students, and ourselves, is we begin to intentionally try to develop moral sensitivity, trying to recognize, is there something wrong out there? One of the things we judge that by is we take a look at the world and in light of our values. As I like to say, we ought to have the scripture in one hand and the newspaper in the other, and be asking ourselves, what's going on today that's not in keeping with my values? The second issue that he talks about is moral reasoning, and that's what we're going to spend some time on tonight. So I won't spend too long on it right at this moment. The next piece is moral choosing. It's one thing to know what it is that you think you ought to do. It's another thing to actually make that choice. We tend to need some inspiration to find the courage to make that choice. And the final one, I just want to spend a moment talking about this, is moral action. This is a research interest area of mine. And one of the things that I'm perplexed by is that there is nothing in the literature that says a person's ability to reason morally, no matter how high that is, has no direct connection to their willingness to act morally. One of the things we look at, I have a fleeting interest in this stuff. I'm just going to paint for a second Kohlberg's stages, just real briefly. Kohlberg believes that people can fall into one of six stages, with one being the lowest and six being the highest in terms of a person's ability to reason morally or ethically. And without going into that too much, because I don't want to spend too much time on it tonight, just take it from me that one is the lowest and six is the highest. And a person researched the testimony given at Watergate. When people were asked to explain their behavior, these were the best and brightest people that we tried to pull around the president. When this person, his name is Steve Candee, researched Watergate testimony, none of the testimony ever got over level 3, moral reasoning, which is that we usually attribute that to junior high school students. Okay? So when asked to describe their actions were not in keeping with their intellectual abilities. One of the things we have in Western culture are a lot of people with superior intellectual skills, but when it comes time to live out of those, to choose on behalf of those, to act on behalf of those, We can miss the mark as a culture. Now I want to tell you a couple stories. One of the next points I'd like to make is that in doing all this research and creating all of these rules and theories that we tend to look at, the notion of values within, and we also tend to look at the whole concept of education within, it's important to note that these theories that people developed were developed on very skewed populations, meaning they did not represent the average American person. Let me explain. One of the founding researchers of this whole area of values awareness, moral awareness, is a guy named Piaget. Some of you familiar with education, that name will ring a bell. Well, this is what Piaget did. The first thing he did was he observed children at play. And the first group he chose to observe were little boys playing on a playground. And he noticed that boys had a tendency to do this, and men in the group, I ask you to reflect back on your grade school days and see if this makes sense. It was recess, and they decided they wanted to play a game together. They chose baseball. And this is what happened. They had about a 25-minute recess. And for about 12 of the 25 minutes, Piaget observed time and time again, the little boys would spend 12 minutes defining the rules of the game. You know, there weren't enough players to have two teams and have a person in each position, so they said, well, you know, if you're a right-handed batter, what we'll do is we won't have a left fielder. So if you hit the left field and there's no fielder there, it's an automatic out. If you're a left-handed batter, fielders will have to switch. And if you hit the right field, then you'll automatically be out. Making all these complex rules about ghost runners and what do you do when somebody's on base and there's no more there's no more batters. Does this make sense? Do you remember these rules? Spending about half the recess time creating these rules for fair play. And then what he observed is that during the game, when these rules were broken or called into question, the little boys appealed to the rules, and that's how they got through these little moral dilemmas that they were encountering out in the playing field. Okay, well, that makes sense. Little boys like to make rules and live by them. And little boys grow up to be men, and men like to make rules and live by them. Well, this is what Piaget observed little girls doing. Piaget observed little girls starting a game of baseball or whatever it might be. And they didn't spend a lot of time making rules. And they began the play. And when something happened that disrupted the play, that caused the conflict between a couple people in the group, they ended the game. And women in the group, does this make sense? They ended the game and chose another activity because apparently the conflict was getting in the way of the friendships. Now, this is an important point. Piaget observed that, and he said, little girls have a lesser sense of justice than little boys. And so we get a whole theory of education about how to deal with little boys and little girls in the classroom, believing that by their very nature, little boys are going to do a lot better in the classroom than little girls because they know how to follow rules. Onto the scene comes Lawrence Kohlberg. He was interested in the work that Piaget did, so he was going to study it further, and he developed these six concepts, or six stages of moral development. Here's what Lawrence Kohlberg did. He wanted a very representative sample. Most researchers do, so he decided to interview 70 boys who were employees of staff members at Harvard, who were the children of employees of Harvard University. There's a representative sample. This is what Kohlberg did. Let me give you this dilemma. And I'm going to pick on a couple people in the group here. Here's the dilemma. He would come up with these hypothetical dilemmas. They would try to put, remember I had those values up here, and I said a dilemma is when two values are in conflict. This is what Kohlberg did. He would create these dilemmas that would have these values in conflict. And this is one of them. It's one of his classic ones. It's called Heinz and the Drug. See, there was this little village over in Germany, and Heinz was married, and his wife was dying of cancer. And there was a druggist in the village who had developed a rare form of radium that would cure the cancer. He had developed it and was asking $2,000 for a dose of the drug, which would cure Heinz's wife. Well, Heinz went everywhere, to his family, to his friends, to the church, and all he was able to raise was $1,000. So he went to the druggist and appealed to the druggist's goodwill and said, all I have is $1,000. I'd like to let you sell me the drug anyway. Well, the druggist said, you know, I invented the drug and I think it's worth $2,000 and I'm sorry I'm not going to sell it to you. So Heinz walks away with his wife dying. And the question he's confronting is, should he steal the drug? Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kohlberg gave this question to boys and girls, women and men, and I'm going to demonstrate in just a second that he also came up with some interesting theories. But let me just ask a couple people in the group. Let's say that you're Heinz. Would you steal the drug?
No.
Okay, why? This is what Kohlberg would do, by the way, but in a more private setting, so thank you for being put on the spot. It's not so important what the person decides as the thinking behind it, so why would you not?
No, because if it's against the law, the consequences, it may cure your wife, but you end up not knowing what the consequences are for being convicted of theft.
Okay.
Up to jail or death.
All right. Let's stay with that, okay? Remember that answer. Would you steal the drug and say that you're Heinz?
Yes, but I'd leave $1,000.
Okay. Okay, so you only stole $1,000.
Right.
Okay. So You would steal the drug?
Yes,
if it was your husband?
The consequences would then fall on me and he would be cured.
Okay.
I could live with the consequences.
Okay.
I could not live with knowing that without my help he died.
Okay. So you would steal it, the drug for your husband? Would you steal the drug for your brother?
Yes.
Okay. Would you steal the drug for a street person?
Probably not.
Okay.
Because I don't love him.
Okay, so what we see, this is what Kohlberg was getting at. In this case, it was kind of no, because we're appealing to the law. The law says I shouldn't. If I took the drug, I don't know what would happen to me. And, you know, I can't risk that. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Here, it's yes, because love is more important than property. Okay? Now, it just so happened that I picked on a man and I picked on a woman, and it just so happened that what we see beginning to emerge is that men typically, not always, but typically appeal to the rules that we developed on the playground. Women typically appeal to relationships. Now, here's what Kohlberg said. Kohlberg interviewed this little guy, Jake. I have to tell you about Jake. See, Kohlberg, he really did some amazing research, and I don't mean to criticize him, because he followed these people for about 12 years and interviewed them about 4 times every year. It's some amazing research. I have to tell you a little story about Jake, which will give you a little insight into level one. And I just love this story about Jake. And again, it doesn't have to do with what you say, but why you say it. This was Jake at 7 years old. Jake, would you steal the drug? Yes. Well, why? Well, you know, what if Heinz's wife is a good cook? You know, and if she dies, who's going to cook his meals? Okay, level one is that we tend to do the right thing, but we do it for self-interest. Okay, now this is Jake at about 12. Jake, would you steal the drug? Yes. Why? This is Jake responding now, and he'd been asked the question about 40 times, so he was getting good at it. Would you steal the drug? Yes. Well, why? And Jake answers basically because life is more important than property. And that Kohlberg rates him at level 4, moral reasoning. And that's exactly where he'd rate your score as well. Now he asks Amy a question. Amy had been asked these questions since she was 7 and 12, but something's beginning to happen to Amy. She's 12 years old now. See if this rings a bell for any of you when you first heard the dilemma when I explained it to you. This is Amy at age 12. Amy, would you steal the drug? I'm not sure. Well, Amy, let me repeat the dilemma for you. You know, Heinz, blah, 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 blah. Amy, would you steal the drug?
Yes.
You know, I'm just not sure. You know, doesn't the druggist have some responsibility in this? Doesn't the druggist have some responsibility to sell it for a decent price? I mean, it's Heinz's wife's life on the line. Doesn't the druggist have some responsibility here? Amy, you're misperceiving the dilemma. You know, it's about Heinz. It's Heinz's dilemma. Don't bring the drug. Don't try to complicate this. Let me read it to you again. Well, Amy's, you know, is very confused. She wants to bring something else into the dilemma. And actually, because of that, and this is all in the written record that we can all go back and look at, Kohlberg rates Amy at a level 2. Again, saying just what Piaget said, that women have a lesser sense of justice than men. As a matter of fact, Amy was having difficulty perceiving the dilemma, according to Kohlberg, when in actually, Amy had given an additional dilemma, didn't she? Because it was the notion of relationships. You know, Amy, towards the end of this interview, says, I don't know, you know, well, what if I did steal the drug and then I go to jail? Well, we wouldn't be together anyway. You know, and it's this whole notion of relationships that Kohlberg wasn't sure what to do with, so what a lot of researchers do when they have information they don't know what to do with, they throw it out. They say it doesn't fit the scheme, it must be skewed information. So what we have in the whole field of moral development, which has affected education in the Western world to a large degree, is we really have half the truth. What we have is a male sense, a male perspective on what is right, what is the just thing to do. And what we've done with people like Amy and the girls who are playing on the field that Piaget observed is we have their experience what they might teach us about how to resolve conflicts, we have that dismissed as ineffective. This is a point I'd like to make, and if I make one point tonight, I'd like you to take this one with you. It's the power of the definition. If you're writing a book and you're defining terms like Piaget and Kohlberg, one of the things they did is that they took Amy's notion of moral reasoning and didn't define it as different and equally valid. They defined it as different and deficient. Different and less than the answer that they were looking for. Amy's answer wasn't what Kohlberg was looking for. He was looking for something that basically said life is more important than property. And Jake later, when being asked about that dilemma, said, well, you know, solving these things is kind of like a math problem. Math problem involving people, right? Take A, add B to that, you get C. And for Amy, it was complicated by a whole network of relationships. And we threw that out. Let me give you an example of this. Northern Ireland. Violence in Northern Ireland for years. People tried to appeal to Parliament. People tried to appeal to law and order systems, justice, more defense, riot-trained police. The whole notion of what we need is more law and order. If we have laws, people will follow them and there'll be less violence. A woman named Betty Williams, who received the Nobel Prize for Peace about 10 years ago, did this. She walked out of her house one day, and a bomb went off and killed a three-year-old child, and the child landed near her feet. Well, moved by that, moved by the loss of life that she observed, she decided that she was going to try to do something about the violence in Northern Ireland. She didn't go to Parliament. She didn't go to the police. She didn't try to create a new law. What she did, and why she won the Nobel Prize for Peace, is that she went knocking on her neighbor's doors. She used the concept of relationships. You know, if I can only relay this story to people, what I just saw, then, like me, they're going to become concerned enough, convinced enough that we need to change things, that some real change will take place. And she began the whole concept of what we call networking. You know, I'm going to tell these three people, and maybe one of them will tell somebody else. And what we see is a whole different phenomena of change. That, as a matter of fact, we look at more and more and we say, that might be a pretty significant way of making change. But again, that hasn't always been given a lot of credence because we've depended on male views of things. What I'd like to do, and not spend too much more time on the theory stuff, because I'd like to get us talking about this in small groups about how this might affect our neighborhoods and churches when we get home. And I don't know if you can see this in the back, so I'm just going to go over this quickly. If we take the notion of justice, what Kohlberg called justice thinking, what we see is that things are, according to Kohlberg and others, logical. That Kohlberg really rewards logic, that justice is connected with logic. And so we get hierarchies. And so when we look at male organizations, we see things like this. Here's the president. Here's a vice president. Here's another one. Here's somebody else who reports to the president in a kind of a sneaky way. What we find is that, and this is typical of male organizations, is that male organizations typically look at hierarchies. One of the things that happens in hierarchies is that we can create procedures, and procedures answer dilemmas for us. Well, what about this unique case? Well, we better not do that. You know, we'll be setting a precedent. And this is the procedure anyway, so let's be going, let's just do what the procedures say. We set up organizations to do that, and typically, what I like to think is that justice is really, what Gilligan would like to substitute justice with is care. What Amy was talking about, what Betty Williams was talking about, is the notion of care. That somehow I can influence the world by caring about things, by caring about what is the druggist's role in that moral dilemma, by caring about the people I'm playing with so that we decide to stop the game instead of continue the conflict. It's an equally valid ethic. I don't think Gilligan would want us to replace justice, but to allow care to be an equally valid choice near it. But typically, for men, justice is really care at arm's length. You know, men find it difficult to be close to one another. We can talk more about this later, and you can catch me afterwards. I don't want to spend a lot of time explaining this next comment, but I believe a lot of that has to do with homophobia. A lot of that has to do with the fact that men don't know how to be caregivers to one another, and so we set up organizations that really keep us at a distance. Here I am in my box. You stay in yours. And if we need to communicate, let's do it along this very thin, narrow line. That's how we draw systems. When women draw systems of organizations, women do this. That's me. And since you and I work together and actually spend time together, ooh, watch this. Let's let our circles touch. And this defines the part of our jobs that we really collaborate in. And this person down here works with me and not with you, so we do that. But this person here works with all of us, so we do that. Women, when they conceive of organizations, do it differently than men and add the notion of contact, of connection. Let me just go through a couple of these things as it relates to justice. Justice gives us logic and hierarchies. We solve problems as if we were strangers. I'm in this box. You're in this box. This is what the procedures say. Forget the particulars in this case. Think about management articles that you've read. Get to know the people in your organization so that you can what? Influence them more. If I know what makes you tick, I can influence you more. So we get to know the people who we work with, not to care about them, but to influence them. And another way that we look at leadership in male organizations is we take control for others, there should be four, and we make decisions for them in the best interest of the group. This notion of taking power, taking responsibility. That's how our organizations are designed. We're beginning to see a change in that. If you look at organizational theory, it's changing. And what people are adding, although they're afraid to give it the name, is they're adding the feminine perspective. We're talking about grassroots change. We're talking about grassroots organizations, quality circles. What do we do in quality circles? We get people together and ask them the question, how would you do your job better? We let them spend time with each other so that they can inform each other in the context of relationships how to do their job better. We're afraid to call it the feminine perspective, but that's exactly what we're adding. Prior to the notion of justice affecting leadership, it really affects the way we learn. And take a look at this next piece in terms of how we structure learning environments. It's also beginning to change, but this is a typical learning environment. We have separate approaches to knowing. We value critical thinking. Accent on the critical. Heart is encouraged to be detached. Don't get emotional. Don't get emotional. What does logic say? One of the things we reward is unbiased judgment. You know? It doesn't matter what this person's particular needs are. What is unbiased? We reward unbiased judgment and objectivity. And look at this concept down here, how that relates. Blind justice. The notion of blind justice. Me somehow believing that if I shut my eyes and if I don't know the particulars of your life in your story, that somehow I'm more effective at being an educator in your life, being a helper in your life. The less I know about you personally, the belief is, the more I can help you. And one other interesting one I like is that collaboration in the male system is called cheating. That if I ask you for an answer, if I ask you for your perspective on things, that's cheating. I need to do my own work. This is how the notion of the feminine might change that a little bit. If we add care to the concept of leadership, under the care system, leadership is seeing that all people, all of their voices are included. That pieces of each person's idea are important.
Isn't that collaboration?
You bet it is.
Well, we just said that it's only the males that make the mistake of thinking collaboration is cheating.
Well, yeah, and so what I'm saying is that typically in male systems, we would reward people for doing their own work. You know, males typically were responsible for designing the, you know, high schools that we went to. In my high school, if I was looking at somebody else's paper, I was told that I was cheating. Now, as I visit my son's classrooms now, one of the things they do is they get them into small clusters and they actually encourage them to share answers with each other. Something happened, something changed. And I think it's the feminine that's being added again to the picture. Perspective calls from the group its goals and desires. And when we listen in the feminine perspective, we listen to people as if we're listening to a friend. It's the notion of relationships again. What we, in this paradigm here, knowing is considered connected knowing, not separated, but we're connected to each other. And knowing is really connected to the capacity for empathy. The degree to which I can understand you as a person is the degree to which I'll know you more effectively. There's a desire to know the other's world. If I know what makes you tick, if I know what influences your life, then somehow I know more about the world. It's an other-oriented focus. That I want to know the story behind the idea. I don't want to just know the concept, but what's the story behind the idea? And I think this is a beautiful thought here. Others allow us, and again, this is the feminine, others allow us to go beyond the boundaries of our imagination. Somehow, my perspective of the world is limited. I only see things through the cultural identity that I have, through the personal history that I have, and that's a limited view of the world. If I can really appeal to your view of the world, somehow my view of the world is made bigger. And the accent is on in empowering others. Let me stop there, because that's a lot of theory, and that's not what I want to spend our time on today. Is this making sense?
Yes.
Okay. Let me do one last thing with us, and then we're going to get into some small groups. I think what's really helpful in trying to demonstrate the difference between these metaphors, let me read something here. First of all, from Carol Gilligan's book in her preface, which I think is really important. I keep using masculine and feminine, I hope, but notice I'm not using male and female. Men don't have to be locked into this. Women don't have to be locked into this. Let me read her piece. She's talking about different voices, new voices that we need to hear, that people like Piaget and Kohlberg, although well-intended, really missed. And this is what she says. The different voice I describe is characterized not by gender, but theme, meaning the themes in my life affect whether or not I view things from a feminine or masculine perspective. And I can choose to be open to new themes in my life. It's not gender-related. In association with women, it's an empirical observation, and it's primarily through women's voices that she's experienced this, but her belief is that men are equally capable of living out of the feminine side of themselves. And what's more, our culture has not only limited men in their ability to live out of the feminine perspective, but we've limited women to live out of the feminine perspective. A lot of women who read this for the first time say, now I know I'm not crazy. You know, I always felt those things, I always believed those things, but the culture never rewarded that. And I'd say our culture is different in the last 5 or 6 years, is my observation, and we see a lot more of the feminine in a lot of the organizations that we're connected to. But what's really helpful, I think, for a last look at the difference between these two concepts is to try to do it with a metaphor. And the two metaphors I'd like to give you, the first one, if you'd like, you can close your eyes and imagine this. First one I'd like you to imagine is a mountain. And picture the mountain. The mountain is really life. Place yourself somewhere on the mountain. Where are you on the mountain? What can you see from the mountain? Depending on where you are on the mountain, would you like to be somewhere else? How would you have to move? Which direction to get there? If you can, your very talented video cassette in your mind, change channels now. Remember that picture of the mountain. But I'd like you to picture something entirely different now. I'd like you to picture a net. Whoever that net comes to mind, the net would be big enough to hold people. Picture yourself in this net of people. Where are you in the net? What is it like to be in the net? What can you see? What can you experience? I'm going to ask you to choose now, if you can, create a split screen in your mind with the mountain on one side and the net on the other. And make a choice. Do you prefer to be on the mountain or in the net? And as you make that choice, you can open your eyes and come back to this room. And let's talk about that a little bit. Can I see hands for people who preferred the net? Right, real high. Raise them high. Okay. Anybody like to talk a little bit about why the net? Those of you who chose the net, yeah.
For me, you said the net. I was always fascinated by Genesis when they flip off the net. And that's where I imagined myself, was flipping out. So seeing the net with people, it was comforting to flip out of it.
Okay.
Because there was air there. And on the mountain, I was almost to the top. And to get to where I wanted to be was on the other side, so you had to go up and over. So it was better to be flipping out.
Okay. How about some others who chose the mount or the net? Could we hear about that choice? Yeah.
My net was a trampoline, and I was on the same level with everyone else.
Okay.
And we could change places and go somewhere else, but it wasn't up or down. And on the mountain, I had to, I was looking down on everyone else, and or I could go higher.
Okay.
And where it was lonelier at the top.
Lonelier on the mountain. Okay. One more net story. Men who pictured yourself in the net, raise your hand.
Mine was just related to people and reciprocity and interaction, despite the fact that I love mountains and high places.
Okay, the net was a better choice. Men who picked the net, raise your hands real high. I thought that was the case, that's why I wanted to check. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Just felt more comfortable in the net.
Okay. Did anything?
I wasn't very high up the mountain.
You weren't very high up the mountain.
No.
Okay.
Still in some trees and seemed nice looking around from there.
Okay. All right, let's hear some mountain story. Who chose mountain? Bob?
Well, I chose a mountain. I've never been in the net. I've been on lots of mountains, and I recall any specific mountain from my boyhood.
Okay. All right. Who else was on a mountain? Yeah.
I was on the top.
All right.
And it felt wonderful.
Terrific.
I didn't have any pain coming down, which I have right now.
It's one of the nice things about mountains in our lives.
But it was very beautiful, and I could go around if I wanted to be down with people. And I really like it up there.
Great. Let's do one other mountain. Would like to go? Yeah.
I was also on the top.
Okay.
And it was just an exhilarating feeling to have made it.
To the top. Okay.
And I could easily go down, but it was tough getting to the top.
Okay.
Feeling of conquering.
I would choose the mountain always because of the sense of freedom of movement. You could go in any direction if you didn't like it in one place. You could look around, go either way, up or down, and stay at the top. You had so much more choice. In the net, you were confined, and you felt closed in. And you were just there. There was no place else to go.
Okay. I think it's an interesting metaphor. One of the persons that I first saw use this metaphor is a woman named Mary Belenke. She was a graduate student of Carol Gilligan's and co-authored a book with several other women called Women's Ways of Knowing. I would also recommend that book to anybody in the room as an outstanding way to look at the ways in which we might learn differently from the feminine perspective. And what Belenke found is when she typically asks a group this question, women typically choose the net, and men typically choose the mountain. Now, there's something about mountains all around us here. I don't know if that's affecting the metaphor, but again, I don't think this is gender specific. We ought to feel free to be anywhere. But I think what we ought to do, and what I'd like to challenge us to do in just a couple minutes, is to consider how when we look at the world simply through the eyes of justice, or simply through the eyes of care, how we are only really examining half of the truth. That if there's equally valid but yet different ways of perceiving the world from what we consider traditional, then how can we in our own lives learn to add the other? Whether that's through relationships that we have, people can help us see that perspective, or what's even more difficult yet more rewarding is to develop that in ourselves. Because this is typically, according to the metaphor in Belenke, this is what happens on the mountain. And picture yourself in the mountain. It's difficult to hear, I don't know about you, but when I'm up in the mountain, it's difficult for me to hear. If I'm talking to somebody and they're a ways off at a distance, it's difficult to communicate. You can do that, but I usually need to hike faster if I'm hiking with my kids, catch up to them, and then tell them what I want to let them know. One of the things typically up in the mountain is we tend to rely more on vision than any of our other senses. Kind of what I see defines reality. Typically up in a mountain, I don't know if many of you pictured it this way, but oftentimes in that metaphor, it's a kind of going it alone. Did anybody place yourself in the mountain with others? Okay, some did. That's terrific. One of the images that we have in our culture, in Western culture, is that I'm considered successful by the accomplishments that I've had, that I've made, and the notion of going it alone. The lone person in this culture is a metaphor I think that's used often. You know, you're going to get out there and conquer the world. We use a lot of images that put the individual kind of almost in competition with the society. And one of the things that can happen to us up in the mountain, not necessarily, is we can lose a sense of connectedness. In the net, by contrast, in the net, in that image, you can picture yourself in the net, we're aware of the slightest movements in the net. That might be a concept for those of you who are experiencing community here at Holden for a longer period of time, those of you who have been here for a year or more, you might have a sense of what it's like to be in community and to know when the community is just slightly out of alignment. We develop different and more senses in that way. We don't typically rely on just vision, but all of our senses. In the net, it's difficult to find room for me alone to win. In the net, if one wins, the only way one wins is if everybody wins. It's easy to feel interdependent in the net. As a matter of fact, you are in that image. It's a confining, tight place to be, and we are more interdependent. But it's also harder to act out of our individuality, out of our separateness. So I would say that what we need in our lives is a blend of each of these, that somehow these things feed each other. And what we need to do is to give ourselves permission, whatever image you like, justice and care, separate or connected, mountain and net, three different ways to look at this single concept of how can we begin to blend the feminine with the masculine in our lives. I think that the church is a great place to start. And let me try something. I wasn't sure I was going to try, but I'd like to try it because it's an image that I think is really important. I'm going to try to contrast the notion of justice and care and how I really think that care is a higher order value than justice. In the Christian church, we've been able to come up with documents that say that it's possible to have a just war. You know, we have the just war theory. We can all go read it. One of the things we can do in the just war theory is kill anybody we like. You know, as long as they're not civilians or children, or in a Red Cross vehicle. And then everybody else is kind of free game. There are other elements of the just war theory, but you know, that's a very simplified version. But justice, as we know it, allows us to fight a war. Picture for a moment a caring war.
No, in fact, there is a care war theory. Mm-hmm. It's a theory, an alternate defense theory for countries, which relies on civil disobedience instead of on armed resistance.
Okay. So it's a type of conflict.
Well, the theory assumes that if your country is invaded, the best way to defend it is not to resist with weapons, but to organize a massive civil disobedience.
Okay.
Which is a care war.
Let me try to show you one other way in which justice, and not what I would call biblical justice, but that which we've labeled justice in our culture, how it can be, how it can really work against, I think, that what the gospel calls us to. Let's say that three of us here, the four of us, decided to play Monopoly this morning. Okay? And since I brought the game into the village, in addition to Parker Brothers rules, these three people agreed to play with me. In addition to Parker Brothers rules, I added a few of my own. Okay? And here they are. Number one, I own all the utilities. Okay? I own the railroads. I don't own them, but I'm the only one who can buy Boardwalk and Park Place and the green properties, okay? You have access to Baltic and Mediterranean. You don't have that.
You
So because it's the only game in the village, and these folks have, you know, been to all the crafts and all the sessions, are just tired, you know, and they decide that they want to play Monopoly with me. So, you know, we're playing, and we started about just after breakfast, and it's about 9 o'clock. And I've already got hotels in the green properties, and I'm beginning to build houses on Boardwalk and Park Place. And every time they come around there, I'm just rolling in the dough, and they cross, go, and they get their $200. But by the time they get around the board, they've lost it because they keep landing on my property. Well, it's about 10:30, and these folks, everything they did own is now mortgaged, and they're coming around the board. And every time they come near me, I'm just nailing them left and right. And all of a sudden, your name is?
Packy.
Packy says to me, "Wait a minute, Bill. You know, I thought this was going to be a fun game. This is not fair. You have more right to buy property than we do." And I say, "Packy, you know what? You're right. You know, tell you what. From now on, you have as much right to buy property as I do. Let's keep playing." You know what we call that in this culture? Affirmative action. We call that affirmative action. Justice. Affirmative action is equal access to a rigged game.
Bingo.
Okay? Now let's say that I really care for these three. What would I have to do?
Start over.
Start over. Ooh. What does that mean? Apologize. What does it mean to start over? Who said that? What does it mean to start over? We're talking revolution, right? We're talking dismantling a system that systematically discriminates against people because the game was rigged when it started. Well, no, in this culture, wait a minute, maybe I'm wrong. All people are created equal, right? Am I right?
No.
And when we created this country, everybody had the right to vote, right? Wrong?
Wrong.
How am I wrong?
Well, if you were male.
Oh, if I was male, white I could male. Vote.
White male.
Oh, and a property owner. Right? rigged game, right? We have a rigged game. Is justice enough to reform a culture that's in need of healing? And if not, how might care assist us? What I'd like you to do is how much time do we have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? How about if you just, for now, why don't you turn to three or four people around you? And we don't have a lot of time for shuffling of chairs. What I'd like you to do is to think about, thinking about the difference between justice and care, I'd like you to think about one thing that you not only can do, but will do. When you go back home in your family, in your community, in your neighborhood, in your church, as you consider how care and justice might fix something. I'd like you to talk specifically, if you're near someone who lives in your hometown, you know, talk to that person because you can support each other when you go back. But for now, turn to someone, three or four people, and talk about how care and justice together might be more effective tools at fixing something. Okay. You know, and again, one of the things that care can do is that if we simply appeal to the justice systems, we may not feel we have as many vehicles as if we think about how can I use my network of relationships to begin to affect the change? I think for now, because we're short on time and we didn't spend as much time in small groups as I would have liked. I got kind of carried away on this stuff. But I guess I'd like to say in closing just a couple things. Number one, if you would consider during the time that you're at Holden, think about how justice and care might intervene and affect any of this other you know, talks you'll be going to, whether it's the environment or better understanding and appreciating gay and lesbian issues, whatever else is going on in the village, consider how these two ethics might affect your view of things. and consider how they might, if you want to do something in response to these many problems, how they might affect about the way in which you approach that. What I'm going to be doing tomorrow morning and on Saturday is taking a look how what I would call slanted or tainted justice yields racism and sexism in our culture. And we're going to be using a little bit of what we've talked about as a basis for understanding the notion of institutional racism and institutional sexism. We as people of goodwill, and I believe that about everybody in this room, if we didn't want racism and sexism to exist, how is it that they continue to manifest themselves after so long? And we're going to be taking a look at this notion of slanted and tainted justice and how it really creates those structures which continually do systematically oppress women and people of color in this country. Before you go, let me again promote this book to anyone that's interested. If you want to know more about the ethic of care, this is just an outstanding book. And Jan and I spent a little bit of time this afternoon looking at some materials that are in the resource room. There's a piece here called On the Transformation of Complex Systems, and which in part talking about the ethic of care. Here's another one, I think, which is entirely the ethic of care, on being a loving invader of your new neighborhood. If you're in a new neighborhood and you want to know about how to change things, how to be a loving invader. This is right up your alley if you'd like to do more reading about this stuff. Old paradigms of protection values, emerging paradigms of growth values. I think that's other words for justice and care. And visions of an inclusive church, I think also speaks to the ethic of care. And then finally, developing a community of faith, which I think is directly connected, again, to the ethic of care. Let me refer you to those in the resource room. Thanks a lot, especially for putting up with all my talking.